Welcome to Regenerative Mindset. In this podcast, we'll explore fresh ideas and inspiring stories from trusted voices who share practical wisdom on bringing positive change to our lives, our society, and our world. I'm your host, Stacey Pollice. As a psychologist, regenerative farmer, and climate activist, I've developed a deep curiosity for thriving ecosystems. Whether it's on my avocado ranch in Southern California or in the ways we engage with each other. Join me as I chat with brilliant guests who challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of how we can live more sustainably, healthfully, and regeneratively, to give back more than we take. Together, we'll see how personal healing can create a ripple effect that reaches our communities and even the earth beneath our feet. So let's get curious together. In this special episode of Regenerative Mindset, I talk with two extraordinary leaders, Tony Porter and Kimya Motley, for a deeply personal and powerful conversation. Tony Porter is the CEO of A Call to Men and a world-renowned educator, activist, and author of Breaking Out of the Man Box. His was named one of the top 10 TED Talks every man should see by GQ Magazine, and he advises national sports organizations on promoting healthy, respectful manhood. He's spoken globally on male socialization and violence prevention and has even consulted on shows like Law and Order, SVU. Kimya is an educator, activist, and domestic violence survivor whose incredible story has been featured on Red Table Talk, The Rachel Ray Show, and in Essence Magazine. She's the author of Born of Violence and leads groundbreaking work at A Call to Men, including trainings for major sports leagues, as well as directing their first documentary, Intentionally Erased. During our conversation, we explore the concept of the man box, the harmful social norms that boys and men are taught to follow, and how breaking free can heal individuals and communities. Tony shares how silence from good men can be just as damaging as the actions of a few. And Kimya opens up about how working with men has been an unexpected part of her own healing journey. We talk about how compassion and accountability must go hand in hand, why emotional literacy is vital for the next generation of boys, and how building a healthier society starts with calling men in rather than calling them out. The conversation is filled with vulnerability, courage, and hope, and it's a call to action for all of us to do better, be better, and build a more positive and regenerative world rooted in respect, authenticity, and love. Well, hello, Tony and Kimya. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, how are you, Stacey? Thank you for having us.
Yeah, hey, Stacey, good to see you.
I've been looking forward to this. We all met about a year ago, almost a year ago, the Giving List Women Summit here in Santa Barbara. My husband, Ron, and I were so impressed that we just had to bring you back out. So you came in October and did a fabulous workshop with mostly men, a group of men, but also women, which is something I absolutely love about the way you work, is the issues that you tackle, violence against women and girls, it needs to be handled by all of us. So I want to share you now with the broader listeners. So what can you tell us, each of you, in brief? Tony, let's start with you, is how you came to this work.
Yeah. Well, I was a social worker working in the substance use field. And in the programs that I worked in, you would have many women who would come in who were victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. You have men who would come in who were perpetrators who also have been victims, particularly of sexual assault. And so we would have the outside services come into the community to provide them with those areas of expertise. And as I listened and learned, I became more and more interested. particularly at that time in working with men who were offenders of domestic violence. I started volunteering doing that and learning more, became faculty of a national collective of people who would go around the country teaching those who work with men who are offenders of domestic violence how to do that effectively. And in doing that and practicing those work, I began to realize that what we were engaging men who were offenders of domestic violence on, we really needed to be talking to all men about that, because in essence, we were talking about the collective socialization of manhood, living in a male-dominating society. We coined a term that a call to men called the man box. That's what we were really talking to men about. I also came to know that while the majority of men don't perpetrate violence against women and girls, the problem is we're silent to the violence, right? And in essence, that silence was giving this minority of men permission to act out in the ways they were in the presence of men who would not do such a thing. So what was it about the collective socialization of manhood that allowed this majority of men to be silent to the behavior of this minority of men? That became very interesting to me, important to me. It led to the creation of A Call to Men, the organization we are now today, 23 years later.
To hear Tony say all of that brings back so many memories to me, because exactly why he does this work is the thing that inspired me to get into it. Now, I'm a survivor of gun violence due to domestic violence, and we can definitely share a little bit more about that later. But I didn't have any real interest in working with men at all. Most of the harm that had come to me in my life had come at the hands of men, right? So after surviving being shot multiple times, I really wanted to get into this work to help women and girls escape domestic violence. I heard Tony speak and give a keynote on the man box, and I said, now, this is different. I want to know more about this. But it helped me have empathy for men in a way that I had not had before. It gave me hope and hope for healing for men in a way that I had never had before. And I recognized that it was important for me to not only share my story with women and girls, but to share this with men as well in an effort to engage them, you know, to help us end the violence. And Stacy, quite honestly, I have a little selfish reason for doing it too. You want to hear that as well?
I do, of course.
Okay, because all of the harm that's ever come to me, as I shared earlier, it had come from men. But doing this work helps heal the parts of me that have been broken for so long by men. And what do I mean by that? I watch Tony and all of the men that work with us, right? I watch them with their partners. And that heals the piece of me that thought it wasn't possible for men to be loving towards their partners. I watch them with their daughters and I go, oh, wow, my dad never talked to me like that. He never, you know, treated me in that way. So it heals the little girl in me as well. And then watching them with us, they always look for ways to center our voices and center our leadership as women. And that means like the world to me. So yes, I am doing this work for the greater good of engaging men and helping to end violence against women and girls, but it heals me too.
That is beautiful. I love that. And that is what I notice that the more deeply I get into this work is the paradox of healing harm on all sides. And Tony, I remember at the workshop, you showed the group a video of a little boy getting a shot. And he was probably, what, 3 or 4. And he was getting an owie shot. And he was starting to well up and starting to cry. And God bless, his dad was right there. But it's like, don't cry, be a man. And we saw this little boy go from authentic, responsive, fully feeling to something happening in the moment to, I'm going to override that and shut that down. And that was so poignant. So can you say a little bit about what I'm seeing as the paradox of how we heal beliefs and collective socialization? Like, it seems like punish those men that are doing that harm. And maybe that's actually not where it's coming from, or maybe that's not the answer. What would you say to that?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, Stacey. One of the things that we unfortunately do with boys, and nothing here that we're talking about is an exact science, but far too often is true. We teach boys very early on to shut down their feelings and emotions, right? By the age of between 3 and 5, we're already leaning into boys with don't cry, be a man, be tough, be aggressive, be dominating, show no emotion, you know, be in control. All these messages boys are getting very early on in life. And we're really, is an exercise in defining manhood, masculinity, by distancing ourselves from what we perceive to be the experience of women and girls. So if women and girls can share their feelings and emotions, boys are taught that they can. If women and girls can ask for help, boys are being taught that asking for help is a sign of weakness. You know, and this is being translated to us in 101 different ways, unfortunately. We're being taught that women are of less value, women are the property of men, women are objects, particularly sexual objects. All this teaching is happening to us as boys later to become men. And this issue around emotional wellness, being taught to shut down our feelings and emotions at such an early age, we grow up to be men with limited emotional intelligence. We really don't know who we are far too often, emotionally speaking. And it's catastrophic for us when you allow yourself to really think about it. When you couple limited emotional intelligence with the inability to ask for help, you can see the mental health challenges that it's creating for men. We know that approximately 6 million men go undiagnosed annually for depression and anxiety. We know men complete suicide 4 times at the rate of women. We know that women live 5, 7, 8 years longer than men on average. This inability to ask for help, well, it's a choice, but it's so ingrained with us, it's almost as if it's an inability for help. We know that men who are partnered are healthier than men who are not. And it has very little to do with the man. It's more about that partner that's continually encouraging him to take care of his mental health, to take care of his physical health. They say 40% of men will go into a doctor's office to address a particular issue and will tell the doctor about everything except for that nagging pain that's been in his side for weeks and leave the doctor's office not having told him about that particular thing. So what is it in our psyche as men? You know, that asking for help and being fully vulnerable is such a huge risk for us. So, and it starts out when we're little boys, where we're shutting down feelings and emotions and shutting down our ability to be vulnerable and asking for help, teaching us very early on to define manhood by distancing ourselves from the experience of women and girls. And in essence, when we're distancing ourselves from the experience of women and girls, we're actually distancing ourselves from our own humanity. This starts off very early on, and then it has a huge impact as we go through the journey of life.
You know, Stacey, I'm thinking about another part of that question you asked, which I think leans into that accountability piece, right? We're not removing the accountability piece from men who cause harm. So like, I come from both those schools of thought. So my ex-husband shot me, as I shared multiple times, and I wanted him to serve the full time. Whatever they handed down, I actually asked the judge to set precedence in the case, give him the maximum sentence possible. And the judge did it, which oftentimes that doesn't happen, but that's a whole nother story. But at the time, the judge did it. Now, I didn't hear Tony give this talk about the man box until 8 years after the shooting occurred, and all these light bulbs started going off for me. And I wondered if my ex-husband had someone encouraging him to get help, if he had someone that he could talk to about what was really going on with him, would he have gone down this road? Like, I think about questions that I would ask him. The point that Tony brought up about men going to the doctor and not saying something is going on with you. My ex-husband had been diagnosed with something that he didn't even share with me because he was taught by his uncles and his dad, hey, you don't tell women that kind of stuff. You deal with it yourself. He was going through financial trouble. I knew nothing about it because you were taught you handle this as a man. He never told me. And so this stuff is building in him and it's creating this great anxiety and fear. And Now, while I'm saying all of this, I'm not excusing at all the choice that he made because of it. But I just wonder, you know, if he had someone saying, hey, it's okay to say you're not okay. Hey, it's okay to get counseling. Hey, it's okay to say I need help financially with this situation. Would we have still ended with the shooting that occurred? So that preventative piece is so important. There's room for prevention and accountability at the same time.
Well, that's where the paradox comes in, because I totally relate to this idea of if someone has harmed, you want to punish. And yet that actually feeds potentially more violence into a violent system that we are all co-creating unconsciously, you might say. I mean, I think what I heard was that we all participate in a social system that would hold that women have less value and deserve less respect. And to the degree that we accommodate that, either through silence or compromise, even if it's just fear that I'm just going to go ahead, if I've witnessed harm being done, then I'm never going to do that again. I'm not going to do what that person did. So we all sort of self-oppress, you might say. Men too. I mean, men get that same message. But when you start speaking to specific men's experiences and whether they were hurt or harmed or limited and weren't allowed their full humanity, that's where the empathy starts to kick in. How do you approach that in your work?
It is an art versus science, because we want to create that space to embrace the humanity of men, while at the same time, we have to hold men accountable for their behavior. So that's what makes it an art versus science. Our encounters with men, as you see Kimia and myself here together, that's always important to us. If I'm working with a football team and it happens to be all men, then it's all men in the room. But we don't promote all men engagements as if we can't have honest conversations with women in the space. We need to be in this, as you just shared, Stacey, we need to be in this together. But in our work with men, we really look to have loving and accountable engagement. We believe in transformation. For us, transformation means reaching in and grabbing the hearts of men. And we understand sometimes there's a long, rocky road with many detours to get from our heads to our hearts. But we believe that's where true transformation happens. Far too often in our society, we engage with each other in a transactional way. For us, it's transformational work. As I said, grabbing the hearts of men, ensuring that they leave our presence thinking and feeling differently. And then in order to do that, as Kimia shared, you also have to give of yourself. I can't ask a man to be vulnerable in my presence if I'm not going to be vulnerable with him. So if you're a facilitator, call to men, or a trainer with a call to men, our engagement is not transactional. We have to give of ourselves as well. We believe in storytelling and sharing experiences together with each other. We believe change happens in that way as well. Just the whole human experience of being together with men. But it's definitely an art versus a science to have very accountable engagement that's also loving and kind and respectful all happen at the same time. We don't believe in big eyes and little U's. To hear us at a call to men, identify ourselves as experts. We're not experts. We're just people with information that we want to share with other people in our journey in life.
Well, as a psychologist, I would say that one of my favorite things is embracing my own imperfection and sharing that out, you know, modeling that vulnerability. And I think it can be contagious in that way. When I hear either one of you admit, I mean, to me, it feels like admit an imperfection. I mean, none of us is perfect. In fact, you know, I probably will say something that isn't, you know, perfectly in line with what my goals are. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, these unconscious biases flow from us at all times. But I feel that in itself is very powerful, because there's this notion of good men that you spoke of. We're good men. We don't engage in domestic violence. We don't engage in sexual harm. But there's all these degrees that maybe support it in the larger culture. And it's like, am I guilty of these things? And I know in my own private life and my home experiment, let's just call it, with men who I love, admitting to those imperfections, I don't know how you want to say it, you'll say it better than me, brings so much shame. Like to think that you're framing that something I'm doing is harmful to you or to women in general is just so painful, I can't even take it in. That's what I see, because they're good guys and been habituated and normalized to feel that this is okay. And yet it comes with a little fight.
There's truth in that. We are the first generation of men really being asked to look at masculinity through this lens. And so it's new to us in many respects. And so, yeah, you'll get the pushback from men. For us, it's about staying at the table with men and meeting them where they're at, right? Not having this expectation that they have to have this level of consciousness before we engage. Meet them where they're at, emotionally, as well as physically, you know, geographically. Meeting them where they're at and walking on the journey with them. Helping them to develop a voice, right? This is a new muscle for us as men, having really critical, in-depth conversations around what it means to be a healthy man. Way beyond what we were taught as boys, you know, respect girls, don't hit your sister. You know, that little basic teachings that we had as boys. And I'm not meaning at all to minimize who we are as men, but to have in-depth critical conversations, really unpacking masculinity and it's good and it's bad. Then getting on a journey to redefine it and to teach our boys differently, to no longer just pass down tradition, very robotic way. This is what I was taught, so this is what I'm teaching you. To no longer do that, to really take the time and unpack tradition and decide what we want to hold on to and what we want to move away from. This is an exercise that we collectively as men, this is new to us. So it requires patience. It requires tolerance. It requires staying at the table with men. And that's the work of a call to men.
And I really think about right now, boys are in a crisis, Stacey. They are in a crisis. They are hungry for the answers about what it means to be a man. We were doing some market research and found that the number one question that boys are asking, and I mean 16 to 25, even younger, they're going to YouTube and asking, what is a man? What is a man, right? And so imagine the answers that they get when they go over there. I don't know if you've seen this new series that's come out on Netflix, but it talks a lot about adolescence and how boys are in a crisis, and that it takes about 23 to 25 minutes of surfing on YouTube or on some of these other platforms before they are introduced to misogynistic content. Now, you know, you probably stay on social media more than 23 to 25 minutes. So, of course, they're staying on there that long. Imagine that you're going on there to find out how to shave, because I don't know how to shave and I'm looking up how to shave. Within 23 minutes, you are being introduced to misogynistic content. We've got to be out there in the culture talking to young boys about this is what healthy masculinity is for myself, right? When I'm growing up, I want to know, how does my mom wear her clothing? You try to mirror the person that's nearest you, right? So I'm looking at my mom, I'm looking at my aunties as a little girl. As a teenager, I'm looking at magazines to see what they're wearing, how they're dressing, what kind of makeup they're putting on. Well, boys are doing the same thing. Except now they're directly asking folks who are providing answers that they probably don't need about what masculinity looks like. And we've got to do a better job to be able to educate them on what healthier masculinity looks like.
I mean, the social media, the computer, you know, the internet. It's just a huge conversation. But I wonder if in the 20 some odd years that you've been at this work, if you notice, are there changes? What do you see? And do we go through waves, ebbs and flows of better and worse awareness of these issues? Do you find that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the ebb and flowing is definitely part of the work when you're trying to move a society in the direction of this type of social change.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but beliefs seem at the core of this. Would you say?
Yes, without a doubt. When we started doing this work, it was kind of preaching to the choir sort of thing. It'd just be a few men in the space and largely women. And as we got better at it, start finding our own stride, we develop the skills to really engage critical masses of men. And so if I go back to when we began to where we're at today, we're working with men in spaces you would not have thought of 23 years ago. We work with all five of the pro sports teams in the United States, football, basketball, baseball, hockey, soccer. We work with the military. We work with faith communities. We work in all spaces where you find critical masses of men, you can find us. That would not have happened years ago. We're in middle schools, high schools, colleges around the country. We have done a great job in building awareness over the years. We have done that. Today, to Kimya's point, today, media has become much more effective, very effective in taking back many of our gains. We have been in really maintaining them and growing them. We are not doing as well in the realm of social media in continuing the gains around the promotion of healthy, respectful masculinity as we are in losing many of the gains we've made. So in many places, we're doing great. We're getting messages out, but we're not seeing the change to the degree we would like to actually see in our society.
Yes, and Tony, I want to ask you to dig in a little more with that. One of the things I appreciate about you sharing, because you've been doing this much longer than I have, right? When you think about the stats about violence against women 20 years ago versus the stats on violence against women today, will you talk a little bit about that and whether there's been change where that's concerned?
It has not been a lot of change. We know today that 30% of women who are killed in the United States of America are killed by the man who says he loves them the most, right? They're victims of domestic violence. That's the same stat it was 23 years ago. We know still today that 7 out of 10 women who are killed during or after a separation. Kimya of assault happened during a separation. We know that still to be true today. We know still today that 1 out of 6 women will be raped. One small change in the stat, and you can see the positive and the negative of it. When we first started doing this work, 1 out of 4 women will be sexually assaulted while in college. Today is 1 out of 5 women will be sexually assaulted, not just during college, but we were looking really at that age. So that's less, but when it was 1 out of 4, it was age 18 to 25. Now it's 16 to 24. Right. So in one respect, you can see where we've done a little better. In another respect, you can see where it's gotten worse because the women have gotten younger. But also today, we're focusing on trafficking. We hadn't done that in the past. Right. And what do we know? We know the average age of a girl. And yes, we said a girl, the sex traffic is 13. Right. So we're not doing that well. Right. We know more, but we're not doing that well. It's still a tremendous amount of work to do. We also believe that collectively speaking, if women could end the violence on their own, they would have already. We believe is this critical mass of men, the men who don't perpetrate violence in girls, the majority of men, right? We have to get, if you want to take a sports analogy, we have to get off the sidelines, get in it, right? And for most of us, you know, we're resting on the sidelines. We work from a perspective of, as long as I'm taking care of me and mine, meaning my wife, my children, my partner, the women in my family, in my circle, as long as I'm investing in them, I'm doing my share. As long as I'm invested in my sons being good young men and my nephews, I'm doing my share. We're saying there's more to do, and we need men to be invested in women and girls, collectively speaking. We need men to be invested in the well-being of boys and young men who are not their biological children as well, or not their family members. There's a gap that has to be filled. And we collectively as men, we're asking men, use your influence, use your platform. Platform meaning what you choose to elevate. Use your voice. Find a way to get in here with us, because we are starting, I'm going to call it a battle right now.
I love that you're naming the truth of there's more awareness we're gaining in these ways, but we're actually failing the bigger picture. Because when you can be honest, like, that makes me feel like, okay, at least I know where we stand. It's also a message to, again, what we're saying, the good men and the women who love them, we all have to engage in this, because as you call it, a humanitarian crisis. I don't remember where it was, but I heard you say if country A was doing to country B what men are doing to women, there'd be an all-out war. And you're right. You're absolutely right. So if all of us can understand that and raise the importance and the urgency of this issue, what can you tell the good guys, the women who love them? What advice do you have? What are some suggestions? Because we need to hear specifically, like, how can we dig in? It may be right in front of us all, but I'd love to hear it from both of you.
We have a tendency not to use good guys and bad guys, because good guys will allow men like myself to separate ourselves from then the men we would define as bad guys. It allows us to really separate ourselves from, yes, these men are doing things that are inappropriate, without a doubt. But if I call them bad guys and we're over here as good guys, then it's more like the problem is them and we have really nothing to do with that. So for us, it's really about all men. You have men who are perpetrating harm. But the collective socialization of manhood, how we're collectively taught what it means to be a man, that man box, we're all taught within that box. We're all taught based on that collective socialization. Some of us have learned quicker than others, maybe with the support of parents and other people in our lives, to sort through it and understand it. But many of us are just on remote control. We're all taught various degrees to have less value in women, to view women as the property of men, to view women as objects, particularly sexual objects. And then you have men that take that to a place of violence for a whole host of reasons. And then you have other men who don't take it to the place of violence, but we stay on the sidelines, right? We have that thinking in us, and that thinking lends to silence us, lends to allow us to tolerate, lends to allow us to look away, lends to allow us to actually participate, but not to a point of what our society would define as illegal. So I could be coaching boys and using stop playing like a girl and all kinds of derogatory language and terms that we use for women. And I'm using that to motivate boys to play better, right? Now, someone can say, well, that was inappropriate, that was too far or whatever. But it wasn't illegal. I didn't break the law, right? So we have to teach men that, well, every time you tell a boy to stop playing like a girl, well, what are you actually saying about girls, right? What's the message there? Helping men to understand how to be part of the solution instead of being part of the problem. Helping men to understand there's no gray area where I can just hang out at. No, you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem. So again, no big eyes, no little U's, no good guys, no bad guys. When we're doing this work, of course you have men who are bad, doing inappropriate things, breaking the law, and you have men who are not breaking the law, but we're all indoctrinated, we're all taught this same socialization, and we acted out in different ways. And at the end of the day, men who perpetrate violence against women and girls are depending on we, the majority of men, to continue doing what we're doing, right? Which is supporting them through silence, which is supporting them by not educating this next generation of boys to men to think different, to act different, to behave different. It should make perfect sense to we as men. We live in a society that continues to have an epidemic of violence against women and girls. We live in a society where men are in crisis themselves, right? It's a fair question to ask. How is it that a minority of men can perpetrate an epidemic of violence against women and girls in the presence of all of us men who far outnumber them? Two-thirds of us would never do what they do. How does that happen on our watch? That's a fair question for us to grapple with as men. And why do we have this epidemic of loneliness amongst men? Men are in crisis. We're in a health crisis, physical health, mental health. We're in crisis. What is that about that we and men are just standing by and continue to be on remote control? So it's not about good guys and bad guys. It's about us, right? And whether you're going to just stay on the sidelines or whether you're going to get involved in this effort.
And I think about, what does that exactly mean? If I'm a man listening to this, I might say, okay, well, what exactly can I do? What exactly does that mean, right? So I think about fathers, right? Fathers, one, modeling to their boys about what it means to be their authentic selves, right? To express their full range of emotions and encourage their sons to do so as well. To admit that they need help or that they're struggling with something and let their sons know that's okay too. I was a teacher in my former life, Stacy, and one time I've taught all grades pre-K through fifth. It was one of my favorite things to do back in the day. We have to talk about that another time. This little boy in my class, and he made a mistake on something minor, and he started crying. And I remember going up to him. Now he's 4 years old. I go up to him and I hug him and I say, it's okay. It's all right. We all make mistakes sometimes. And he goes, no, it's not. It's not okay. And I said, but daddy makes mistakes too. And all of a sudden he stopped crying and he looked at me. He said, Miss Motley, you don't know my daddy. My daddy does not make mistakes. My daddy does everything great. My daddy knows how to, and he starts listing all of these things. I knew immediately that afternoon I was going to call daddy, right? You got to show him that you make mistakes because he thinks that you do nothing wrong. And he started laughing. And I said, no, seriously, it's messing him up because he doesn't embrace well that sometimes you're not going to get it right. Sometimes you make the mistakes. And the father was so receptive. He was like, okay, Miss Motley, I'll immediately begin to do that, right? Gotta be vulnerable enough to show your son that is okay. I'll give you one other thing too that I think is easy for men to do. When you're at work or you're at school or wherever you are with other men and you hear those sexist jokes coming from their mouths, you've got to be willing to stand up and say, not on my watch. And in a way that you call them in, not calling them out, you can pull them over to the side and say, hey, bro, we don't talk about women like that here. Or, well, how does that make you feel when you're sharing things like that? To challenge them, not about, oh, now I'm a bad guy, but challenge the thinking and help them come around to thinking another way. So that's one with men showing their sons that a different version of manhood that is actually healthier. And another to be able to call your friends in when they're doing things that you know are not uplifting to women, girls, or marginalized groups.
Brilliant. Yes. And I've found that in our own family is that, you know, my husband's had a pretty successful life. And from our children's standpoint, everything's gone well for him. And I've given him a little, tell him when things were really fucked up or when you, you know, almost lost it and what choices you made. Well, guess what? They lean in. They're more interested. Their eyes get wide. Gives them more possibility, because I think they walk into young adulthood feeling like the bar is just so high. And I'm sure it's true for moms and dads in that way. We all look like everything's going well for us in a way, but I think that is brilliant. And also this notion of calling in, because I've been following Loretta Ross on that. And I think that is important. And this takes courage, doesn't it? To interrupt behavior in our peers, our friends. Hey, I just want to talk about that. So what this work is asking for all of us is to really be brave and courageous and with everything around us, because it matters.
It's easier, Stacy, to call men in instead of calling men out. I'm not saying certain men don't need to be called out. There's a time and place for it. But calling, the whole concept of calling men in, if you understand that this collective socialization that's fostering an epidemic of violence against women and girls is also extremely harmful for men. If you understand that men have experienced as well a tremendous amount of trauma in their lives, and it goes unaddressed, unresolved, how we're socialized to view what it means to be a man. You know, I worked in substance use programs, as I mentioned before, doing the work of a call to men. The number of times a man would come into treatment, about 40 years old, and he shares for the first time the sexual assault that he experienced at the age of 8. That means for 30 plus years, a generation, he's been carrying that. And based on what he's taught that it means to be a man, he's buried that or tried to bury it. And the way he continually tries to bury it is substance use, as well as hurting everyone that's vulnerable to him, because he can't admit and talk about the violence he experienced as a boy. And so we know that hurt people hurt other people. We know that trauma can go from one generation to the next generation. And so men need to be held accountable for their behavior, but we have to have hope for the healing of men. We have to look at it from both ends. We have to understand that the investment in healthy masculinity not only helps a society of men, but if we increase healthy masculinity, we decrease violence against women and girls. It's a win-win all the way around. And if we can understand that men need healing as well, it opens the door a lot wider for us to practice calling in versus calling out. Again, not saying that calling out is not ever necessary. Many times it is. But calling men in is really understanding their humanity, their quest for humanity, even when they're looking for it in the wrong places, is a quest for humanity. We talk a lot at the call to men about being your authentic selves, teaching men, engaging men in authenticity. We're far too often to be a role self, R-O-L-E versus our whole self, W-H-O-L-E. And so that calling in is really instrumental in the transformational work that we're engaged in doing.
That's so interesting, because holism is one of the things that I think about a lot as a regenerative farmer. I mean, I'm a psychologist, I'm a lot of things, but I find there are patterns and ecosystems and realities in nature everywhere. So that, number one, having imbalance between male and female in nature, guess what that gets you? A desert. Too of an imbalance. So why would we try to propagate that in our society? It's death to all. And I think holism is everybody gets to be their full self. Now, I know in sexuality that polarity is real. Research would say there needs to be some differences in some ways. And it doesn't have to be as simplistic or overt as I have to act like a macho dude. We all know that sexuality is on a spectrum and all of that. But I think what we need to understand is that in order to hold a masculinity isn't about being macho. Those are two different things. Macho, hypermasculinity, and the role that you're discussing isn't the only way to create that sexuality. And I feel that's part of the story here. Men grow up wanting to be viable sexually. Would you say that has a role here?
When I think about masculinity, I would want to view it as you can define your own masculinity. You don't have to be locked down or held hostage to how it should look, you know, or has to look. You can define it for yourself. And I love the fact that sexuality is on the spectrum. And masculinity needs to be on that same spectrum. It doesn't have to be boxed in and has to look exactly like this. And you got to do it exactly like that, you know, and you can't veer too far to the left or far to the right. Right now you're out of the box. You got to stay in the box. And we're being held hostage to this box. Even many of us who know it's not working for us, many of us who actually have a consciousness that is not working. So many of us are just on remote control, but there are many of us that have a consciousness that this is not working, but we're still afraid. We're still afraid to step away from it, you know, because that fear of how we're going to be viewed by men, how we're going to be viewed by women who are actually adhering to this man box as well. And this is contributing, you know, greatly, or is definitely being used. I'm not going to say contributed because I'm not sure about that. My gut just did a thing just now. But when you think about men in loneliness and how they're actually being taught to hold women responsible for their loneliness, which then feeds the misogyny, right? And the hatred of women. We're going to hold women responsible and accountable for the loneliness that men are experiencing. Not asking men necessarily in many of these dark spaces, not asking men to be authentic, to rethink masculinity and how they're showing up and acting and behaving, or to go and get the help, we're back to help, that they may very well need. Instead of that, we're going to hold women responsible in many of these dark spaces within the internet, and some not so dark, some are like right out there with a click of a button, are holding women responsible for men's behavior and men's thinking and men's decision making. It helps us to understand when we think about the violence, we're barely making a dent in it because we're really being challenged in this current day and age of how to reach these men. And other folks are doing it much better than we are. So on one hand, I'm watching young people today, you know, and their expressions of masculinity and sexuality. They got me doing things that I would not have done as a boy that I do today, you know. The colors that I wear, the way I show up, the love that I give to other men, to be with men and be in the spaces where I was chatting with a dude. He was the receptionist at the hotel, right? The desk clerk. And the dude had these long fingernails that was painted all up, really looking real, really nice. And I said, man, I like them nails. You know, we start chatting about it. And the woman that was next to him that was also, you know, checking people in, it like took her for a loop because she looked at me and she had this stereotypical who I am. And to have me say to the dude, man, I like the nails. I like the way you're doing you. You know, and then as I left to go around the other side of the desk to the elevator, I heard her and him chuckling. And I know they were laughing at, look at this dude here, man. He looked like a hood rat, an old G, they might have called me, right? You know what I mean? And he's telling me he likes my nails, right? Because I'm really practicing hard to be more authentic myself. And so I'm on my own journey, but I know this journey I'm on, I'm a different person than I was when I was a boy. I would have never seen myself feeling the way I do today and viewing things around masculinity the way I do today. And I really love young people and how they're resisting some of these rigid notions of masculinity and doing themselves. They would say doing me, because that all means outside of the box. But at the same time, those who think differently, they're much more skilled and passionate than we are. They're putting the work in. They're really putting the work in on a level we're not, and we're losing.
So I hear what you're saying is that younger generation is, there's a lot more liberation and understanding of spectrum than even my generation, our generation, let's say. but it's not translating necessarily statistically, because you've got, I mean, I never heard of incels, which, if you want to talk about that male loneliness and violence and anger, blaming women for their loneliness. So there's these different elements that are tipping. But I like what you said about that, because that's freedom for you, getting to be a free man and not have to question your own identity around how someone else presents. And that's when you said your gut did a little thing. Well, when I was reading your book, my gut did a little thing, because you were in addiction work, and I just kept feeling like there's something around addiction in this hypermasculinity area. And I thought, it feels like an addiction to power. So there's a little bit of surge power that if I'm exercising hypermasculinity in a space, I get to get a little surge of power, but it comes at a cost internally, because it's actually harmful. Any kind of act against another is harmful. So it has to go through me, and I lose. Something in me has to lose for me to gain power over you. Some part of me has to lose power to another part. So I'm harming myself internally as I gain power. Am I being too esoteric? I'm like that.
I don't know. When I think about gaining power or hurting someone to gain power, I just have to think about, what is it inside of me that gives the green light to that? What is it that inside of me that makes that okay, that harming someone else in that way gives me power, gives me authority, gives me something that I'm yearning for? Right? When I hear myself say all of that out loud, it just does not sound healthy to me. There's something about it that's very unhealthy. And we're not talking about, because some of your viewers might think we're talking about self-preservation, or we're just talking about taking care of yourself. We're really not talking about that when we're talking about gaining power over another human being. You know, at A Call to Men, we do a lot of work around bullying, how that shows up in spaces, whether it's bullying through social media or physically bullying someone. Because we spend a lot of time with young people, and that's an epidemic of that in this age of social media. It is extremely dangerous. And so that quest for power and to get it and then to lean into it, that's very much a part of the man box. This idea of power is very much part of defining manhood. And we look at power in a lot of ways. We look at power through finances. We look at power of our voice. We look at physical power. There is a quest for power. How we go after that and the things we do to get it, they can't only be damaging to the person. Got to be damaging to the soul. And when I'm saying the victim, it can't just be about the victim. They got to be damaging to the soul of the perpetrator to live in that space, to have the ability to tolerate your behavior and to go on as if. What's happening to your soul? And I'm a believer in your soul in that process.
That's what I was picking up. Yeah. In that addiction notion.
I'm thinking a little bit too about what both of you are sharing. Like the thing about power, Tony, you're always teaching that, of course, that is something that's taught in the man box, that men have to be powerful. They have to be successful. They have to be dominating. But that's how the folks that are teaching the men and boys the wrong thing, they're tapping into this little bit that the socialization teaches them. And then they'll say, these are the ways that you can gain it. There was a whole website, Stacey, I don't even know how much shine I want to give it, that was actually teaching young boys how to sexually assault women based upon this false notion of power. You know, when I think about my own life, you know, I shared with you that my ex-husband shot me multiple times. You don't just wake up one day to get shot by your husband. There were things that I endured from childhood leading me up to that moment. I remember the first time that I was physically assaulted by someone, and I was a teenager. Okay. I'm 16 years old. He's 16 years old. He physically and sexually assaulted me. Now, I had the blessing, if you will, to have a conversation with him 2 years ago. I think it was bothering him, and I'm 51 years old now, so it's bothering him that long. He made every effort to find me and reach out to me. He said to me that, I mean, we were dating, 16 years old, and he wanted to be intimate with me, and I did not. I did not feel like I was ready to be intimate with him. So he took that request to his uncle, and he's like, yes, this girl, I like her. I want to have sex with her. She will not have sex with me. I don't know what to do. His uncle told him to punch me and punch me over and over again until I would do this. And this is what he did, right? Now, this gentleman told me, he said, I remember what you had on that day. That is how vivid this memory is in my mind. He said, your face looked so outraged and so hurt, and you started crying. And he said, there was a piece of my heart that felt like, man, I shouldn't be doing this. He was like, but the power it gave me to know that I could get what I wanted by doing this. He was like, I then started doing this to other people. Think about this. You go to your uncle for advice with a pierced, 16-year-old heart. I'm like, girl, all my friends are talking about having sex. Well, I want to have sex too. A genuine question. But the uncle who knows better teaches this young boy, oh, this is what you got to do to get it, right? So I was like, I appreciate you for sharing that with me, because I learned a deeper thing from it. Like, oh my God, we've got to teach boys about all these aspects of things, because they're going to get the information somewhere. And somewhere that they get it may not be a great place. And then what are you doing? You're setting a precedent for him to hurt other women and girls, a precedent for him to be arrested, for him to have lifelong consequences from an honest inquiry.
That is powerful. And one of the things I'm taking away is, believe it or not, hope. His humanity is in there. It was in there at the time, and it's been with him ever since. That just gave me a chill, because your face, he liked you, and what you experienced stayed with his humanity. I see the work, let's just say, of women requires massive amounts of digging deep to find empathy and forgiveness. The wholeness and humanity that resides within men, despite what it looks like, right? Is this a leap of faith that we as women need to take in this moment? Also, for women and men to take this call seriously, urgently, in this moment.
Yeah, without a doubt. I don't know why it came to my mind, but as Kimi was talking about the sexual thought, my mind went to pornography. I don't know why it just did. And then again, coming back to the age of social media, and Kimi was talking about, you might just be looking to learn how to shave, and in 20 minutes, you could be looking at pornography. We know that even boys who intentionally look for pornography, they might just be, and I think it was that innocence that made me think about it when he was talking about he innocently went to his uncle. Boys go online innocently looking to see people having sex because other kids were talking about it. Sometimes they might just find somebody having sex, but other times they might find it way down the line. We know that the average age of a boy that first views pornography is 10, the average age. And it has nothing to do with parental controls. You can have all the parental controls you want. You got friends, got classmates. It does really come down to teaching our children. And also not being caught up into, no way, not my son. You should assume that if your son is 10, you should assume that he may have viewed pornography instead of, no, not my son. Because once he views pornography, if we made that assumption and sat down and talked with him and helped him to understand what he's viewing, the chances of him being healthy in respect to sex and sexuality increases. I was doing some work around sex trafficking, and it was a presenter there who specializes in pornography. And he shared that within 2 to 3 years after a boy first views pornography, because of the stimulation factor, and you think about social media, said within 3 years, he would have 10,000 views. And when you think about the stimulation factor, he'll go from watching two people having sex to watching denigration and dehumanization, which is a form of violence. And then you can understand how misogyny, or how this boy, should I say, may actually become misogynistic just based on that. And the algorithms will feed him. And so it will take him here. It will take him there. It will take him everywhere. It's overwhelming when you think about it, but it's happening every day. The places our children are going as it relates to social media, you know, for me, it was the dirty magazine my father thought was hit. And we take it and pass it around to our friends and then make sure we get it back in that spot before he finds it. That was pornography for us. But today, 2 to 3 years between the algorithm feeding him and the addiction factor views. And let's say he's having those 10,000 views and no one outside of influencers in those spaces, etc., is talking to him. And no one may very well be talking to him because we're all operating under the assumption, not my son. Oh, no, yes, your son. Yes, your son. It's not about him being a bad boy, so you can say, no, not my son, because he's a good boy. We have to have these conversations with our young people. When we talk about sex trafficking, we have to focus on demand. We talk about it being a multi-billion-dollar industry. Well, why is that? How is it? We have to talk about the objectification of women and girls and what that means in a world of a male-dominating society. We have to talk about that. You know, any major sporting event, sex trafficking goes through the ceiling, right? And we think about that as sporting events. But it also happens when the RNC comes to town. It also happens when the DNC comes to town. It's not limited to like the Super Bowl. It's about any major event where you're going to have a critical mass of men. Sex trafficking happens at those events. So it's about demand. And how do we limit demand? It's through the education of boys later to become men.
There's so much in what you just said, and I wish we had more time. So maybe we're just going to have to come back. Because I hear in that whole sexuality piece that desensitization of men's sexuality. And so it seems like the bar has to keep going up, and it actually probably contorts their sexuality in some way that I've heard. I've talked to young men about it, that it's like it can cause a problem. Oh my goodness, so much work for all of us to do. Well, I want to say that I'd love to hear just a couple of your quick takeaways that we can leave with both of you. Just a couple takeaways. There's so much meat here, and I feel more inspired than ever to take these ideas into my own life and speak up in situations and call in situations, not be afraid, because it's really a big deal. It's a humanitarian crisis. I get that. So what other kinds of thoughts would you want to leave us with today?
Athletics, places where many of our boys love to be. Many of us as parents put our boys into sports. We want them to be in spaces with men and other boys and have those experiences and develop themselves, you know, as boys later become men. I want coaches of all elks in all spaces to understand that a big part of their job is character development, right? And when you have these boys sitting on the edge of their seats, or a circle of them, or 40 of them, and you standing in the middle of that circle, and they're holding on to your every word, right? What a wonderful time to talk about something other than football, to understand the influence you have as a man, to truly understand your influence in these spaces with boys. Right. And so your influence and then your platform. What is your platform? What is it that you're choosing to elevate in essence? We want to ask you to begin to develop and use a voice in respect to the promotion of healthy masculinity. You're doing sports, whether you're a teacher, whether you're an instructor, whatever spaces you are, whether you're a dad, an uncle, whatever spaces you are in with boys, we really want you to understand and be part of the effort in promoting, you know, healthy, respectful masculinity. We all can do this, and there's space for all of us to be at the table. It's the only way we're going to ever truly see the change that we want to see.
Yes. Then I think about something that Tony talked about a little bit earlier around the stats about DV, right? Or sexual assault. I often like to say, we know that one out of every three women has been or will be a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault in her lifetime. And so if we know that, we can safely assume that maybe one out of every three men are the perpetrators of that violence. So where are the other two? And Tony leaned into this earlier when he talked about that those men are oftentimes silent to the violence, right? So I often challenge men to be one of the two. That's what I say. I want you to be one of the two who stands up to say, I'm going to be my authentic self and I'm going to express my full range of emotions. I'm going to be one of the two to stand alongside women and girls, to call my friends in, to call my family members in when they are doing things that perpetuate violence against women and girls. And we got to expand what that definition of violence is. That means calling in those comments and those sexist jokes. Calling in coaches when they're telling boys that you're playing like a girl, things of that nature. I want you to be one of those two that are brave enough to say, I'm going to teach my son how to embrace those aspects of manhood that are great, because there are many aspects of manhood that are great. But I'm also going to challenge myself to be one of the two to teach my son that those notions of manhood that do not serve us and do not serve the women and girls in our families and our communities, we're going to let go of those and reimagine what masculinity really is.
There's more people who are not than there are who are. And so keep that in the foreground and then do our part, because what that also means is you have more support than you think. Is another message I hear in that. There's more support. More human beings want things to go well. We've done all those measurements on how the positive hormones increase when we see kindness. It is true. We all feel stress when we experience unkindness of any magnitude. So, okay, well, thank you both again for the work that you're doing, that you're in the field doing it. And I'm going to tell you, when you come to Santa Barbara, we're going to do more, because I know a lot of men who would really like to engage this work more deeply. So thank you both.
Thank you for having me, Stacy.
Thank you, Stacy. It's always great to be in your presence. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. If today's conversation inspired you, you can help us reach more people by sharing this episode with friends or leave a review. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For additional resources, you can visit my website and stay connected with me on social media. A big thanks to the amazing team that makes this podcast possible, including Phil Svitek, Brianna Phipps, Leah Pellegrini, Melissa Walbridge, and Courtney Hamilton. When we all work together, we can create a world where positive change is not just possible, but inevitable.